You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and it's time, Herds.
Flex.
To wrap up book one for 2022. It feels weird being here already. We're discussing chapters 32 to the end of Vassim Khan's The Dying Day. And just, wow, how did we get here so fast, Herds?
Yeah, I mean, look, if nothing else, I feel like this book, we really blitzed through it in a sense. Like, it felt like there was a lot. There was a lot to get through, but it also, like, I just kept turning the page, going from chapter to chapter, character death to character death, watching them drop like veritable flies by the end of the novel.
Yeah.
But you're right. It was a blast for about 90% of the novel, but we'll get into that. We'll get into that discussion as we go, I think.
Yeah. I do want to just start because, you know, obviously last week we had the whole riddle situation, so we didn't really have to recap what happened in the book.
I'm sorry, I got carried away, but yes.
No, that was the design of the episode. It was an exception for the sake of the challenge we were
doing. I understand that, but still, I should show some self-restraint.
If you feel that bad, would you like to do the recap?
Oh, I don't remember the story that well. No, you do it. Look, I could tell you all about the riddles, but the story? Get out of life. You talk about it.
Yeah, so at the start of this stretch, we have the corpse of James Ingram identified. Well done, Herds.
As a Nazi.
As the man who had attacked Persis Wadia in her father's own bookshop. We then get the autopsy. We discover a photo of him and some other Nazi figure in a fishing photograph sewn into his jacket pocket. I don't really know why it was sewn in, but it's
to hide it, you know, keep it somewhere where he can feel it. Can you imagine like staying there in the cold waiting in line to like get across some border and you feel the photo in the jacket, you know it's there. It's like a comfort thing, but you never actually look at it.
You know, that makes
it's like my vibe.
Almost too much sense considering the character.
Too much sense. Shh. Don't think about the character. Just think about what's dramatic and makes sense movie-wise.
Anyway, we then have the autopsy of Ingram. We find that he is a Nazi. He was an SS officer. He has a tattoo as such on his arm.
His blood type. That's great. That's a great detail. Yeah.
And we then get into some just kind of hijinks in stopping his commanding officer, Otto Skorzeny.
Yeah, we find out that Otto Skorzeny, who is a real historical figure.
Yes.
Who was responsible for getting Mussolini out of Italy.
Yeah.
At the end of World War II. Apparently, Vassim Khan has selected Otto to be our principal antagonist. He's after the Divine Commedia because he and Mussolini, they are twins, metaphorically. And as such, they vowed to collect the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, I do have a little bit more of Vassim Khan from when we spoke to him last week to put on the show today. So we'll hear more about that in depth when we get to that discussion in the middle of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But then, Herds, after introducing Skorzeny, we find ourselves on the tale of John Healy's last riddle.
Oh my goodness. Which I solved, by the way.
Yes.
I loved this one.
We're not going to do a full breakdown of it today, but I do want to say Herds did an excellent job. If you could give us the highlights.
I actually was going down the wrong rabbit hole because there's mention of a cutter and many gates. And so I found something called Churchgate, and there was mention of there being like a Navy admiral who'd sunk his ship he had a ship that was called a cutter. And I was like, oh, I'm on the case. Let me look at another part of the riddle. And when I looked up painted ceiling, sun and moon, it came up with the Freemasons Hall, and all of the other details in the riddle fit immediately. And so I realized that all the research I'd done before that moment had been nothing. My final concrete solution was that because it's mentioned that you should find the book between Jerusalem and Mecca, that they were likely referring to the Torah, the Jewish scripture, and the Quran, which is the Islamic scripture.
See, I copped out a little bit on this one. Got to about the same point, but then I assumed that there was going to be like something where a church and a mosque used to be like either side of this particular Freemasons hall.
No. See, I went onto the Freemasons website and I found that there was a page discussing how they keep a copy of every religious text that is incorporated in the Freemasons in a wooden altar in a specific room.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about the actual plot here. So we corner Otto. I'm gonna call him Otto, because then I can just think of The Simpsons and it'll be fine. The guy who drives the school bus.
Yeah, please.
Corners Persis and Fernandez corners him. Essentially, Otto has taken what he believes to be the Divine Comedy, but it's not because it obviously isn't.
Yeah.
Obviously, Persis has a plan here, and he runs away with it, and we reveal where the Divine Comedy has been hidden, and there is some semblance of a wrap up, but that's pretty much the end of like the drama of the novel. Which are we good? Do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to save that for the third part here?
I think the thing that I want to put in here right now is actually something that we hedged our bets on discussing last week,
sure.
Which was the two girls who come up to Persis, in the middle section of the book and ask her to give a talk on what it's like being the first female police detective in all of India,
sure,
and. The bit in the middle section of the book was really interesting because these two women came up and you made the comment to me, Herds, that they were being like very selfish by asking this of Persis when it was clearly something that like she wasn't in a position to do.
Everyone was being selfish to some degree in a good way, in like a this is a good writing kind of way.
And yeah. it was so interesting to me seeing the book end on kind of that.
Well, because it flips around, right? Like yeah. the book ends with her saying, screw it all, I'm going to go give the talk. And she does this because after all of those shenanigans and, not catching Otto, he gets away, but they recover the Divine Comedy. She gets no mention in the police report, in the newspaper report of how the book was recovered.
Yes.
And all the glory ostensibly goes to Fernandez, who I actually want to say I found to be an incredibly compelling character by the end. It's a shame we didn't get to sit down with him and talk to him. But that's okay. But he essentially takes a bullet by agreeing to Persis's plan in the final hours of
He takes a bullet by tripping over in
this
the
is
middle
true.
Of
this is true. Persis's he is not. Plan. Yes, this is true. This is true. It, to be fair, if he'd gone with his own plan, he probably would have gotten himself killed instead of
the,
just getting
the
shot.
The only way Vasim Khan could have made this more literal is if he was carrying a sword
and fell
upon
on
it.
His sword. Exactly. And in indignation, Persis not only decides not to meet up with Zubin, she decides to go and give the talk instead, which is great because it's character development. And it's her like finally deciding to throw her glove into the ring, her hat in the ring, whatever the phrase is, and like
all of the above.
Fight the fight, right? Yeah. Her hat and her gloves.
It's a really satisfying wrap up to what was a very weird introduction in the middle section of the book because we've had her wealthy friend Jaya introduce, whose father was incredibly proud of Persis for punching her in the face and giving her what for. Her like will they, won't they, but in a weird, awkward way. With Archie Blackfinch, we have her entire relationship with the police department.
Yeah, and then they end up going on a date, except in all but name. She's like, if we happen to go to the same cafe together, well, that would just be nice.
The point being that their like introduction was kind of a weird place because we'd already had this long stretch of very uncomfortable ideas, and then just like, hey, Persis doesn't fit in anywhere. And I really like the way that it paid off in the end.
Yeah, I'm glad that we end on a very like definitive point of action.
Yes, it's not like sequel bait. It's just a satisfying full stop.
It's a satisfying full stop. We know what she's going to go do.
Though there is one gripe that I think we both had with this.
Okay, let's get into it. I feel bad because, as you said, like we've enjoyed this book all the way through.
We've had several debates about discussing this on the show because we really like this book, but
the ending. In my opinion, my personal professional opinion on this show, I think the ending is flat. I think the ending is a bit too
sensible,
straightforward. Sensible might be the right word.
The thing that I noticed when we were discussing the novel is that a lot of the ideas that you posed about how things were going to go, your theories, very much framed it as a full tilt spy novel, whereas it's more a historical novel that just happens to have spies in it.
Yeah. Which is fine. Like, I don't mind it not going full Nazi scientist Wolfenstein nonsense. Like, we don't actually have to have undead abominations rising from their graves in the Freemason hole, as much fun as that would be. but I definitely felt, you know, when we're in the scene with Otto and Persis is there, like, oh no, he's taken the wrapped book that we can't see inside. I'm like, well, there's no tension here.
I disagree with you on a few things here. Largely just that I think that, you know, playing to the history and how things went is totally fine because if you're going for a historical novel, it's okay for that to happen. The thing that I do agree with you on, though, is that Vasim struggles to restrain himself on espousing the history directly,
yeah.
which is totally fine if you're into like learning the history along as you go with the book, which I do enjoy and I think that it's great. But Vasim's level of restraint may not be compatible with everyone.
Yeah.
Anyway, that will wrap us for this section of the show. We're going to be back with the mystery and more after this little old interview here with Vasim Khan himself. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is 2SER 107.3, your murder mystery world tour. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here with you. Now, last week on the show, we had Vasim Khan on to talk a little bit about The Dying Day, which is the novel that we're discussing today. And I wanted to bring you a bit more of that discussion. Last week, we spoke a little bit more about the riddles, a little bit more about who Persis is. And I wanted to get into some of the other peripheral characters that we had over the course of the novel, because we haven't touched on them, I think, as much as they deserved. So here is us talking with Vasim Khan, speaking a little bit about the broader cast of The Dying Day.
One thing that you have been, threatening to explore the whole way through the series is Persis' romantic side. She's resistant to it both because she's quite an awkward character and because she'd immediately get the boot if she got married off the force. Now, does the franchise hinge on Persis resigning herself to eternal awkwardness, or do you have a path in mind to get the best of both worlds?
Well, you guys are probably too young to remember a terrific show, the show that made Bruce Willis famous, Moonlighting. Now, that show, some of your listeners might remember it. It was successful because of the whole will they, won't they between Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd, which they managed to carry on for God knows how many series. And in my case, it's between Persis and Archie Blackfinch, who's an Englishman, he's a white chap, and he's in Bombay to help the Bombay police force set up a forensic science lab. He's got his own set of idiosyncrasies, and the pair of them initially start off antagonistic, as all good romantic encounters should do, but then we realize that there is this mutual respect and attraction developing over the course of the series. And as far as I'm concerned, the longer I can keep that tension running without resolving it for the reader, the better. Because there's nothing worse than having all of your questions answered, really.
I mean, theoretically, you keep it going until the end of time. episode 100, you know, in the
Persis. It's true. You have really crammed both books into the first few days of 1950. It's true. There's plenty of more days left on a calendar.
You could have one book every day, practically. You could have 365 days worth of books in 1 year. I'm just saying the opportunity is endless. I'd capitalize.
Well, yeah, the thing I wanted to mention is that Archie took a real kind of backseat in this book compared to Midnight at Malabar House, instead focusing more on like the dysfunctionality of her working with Fernandez after his previous betrayal. Was it easier for you to write a working Sherlock and Watson, or did the chaos of Fernandez and Persis make the other pairing a bit more fun?
Well, I just don't like Archie.
No, really?
Curious.
When you have a cast of characters, if you try and shoehorn a lot of stage time in for every single one of them in every episode of your series, it becomes quite boring for the reader because you have to find things for them to do. We can't just have Archie coming along and taking up loads of chapters where he doesn't do anything. And if there isn't something credible for him to be doing within the course of that investigation, then I'm afraid the spotlight has to return to the lead character, and that's Persis.
I wanted to ask about Neve Forrest, though, because she really got the cold shoulder by several characters. I really love the moment where the Greek scholar corrects her translation. That was classic. But it also, in some senses, the story. She's got the too obvious to be the culprit archetype in a lot of ways, but gets consigned to a glum-looking photograph in the Chronicle newspaper at the end rather than the redemption that that archetype often gets. Why did you give the ever obnoxious journalist Shana the last laugh in that situation?
Well, I can't say that it was a conscious decision. I mean, Neve Forrester is an intriguing character. So she's one of these Brits who are known as stayers on. So they're Brits who have spent so much time in India that even when independence swung around, they couldn't imagine themselves going back to a life in the home counties or back in the Highlands of Scotland, for instance. So for her, there was never any question of going anywhere else. However, she is also from an era where the Brits were top dogs. And she has that sense of people, you know, snapping to when she says something or when she orders them to do something. It's very difficult to let go of that just because someone tells you that the damn natives are now independent. And so I guess maybe that's a subconscious reason why Channa, who is, yes, as you rightly say, an obnoxious journalist, but he's an Indian nonetheless. Maybe perhaps that's why I gave him the last laugh, as you put it.
Yeah, well, I guess the other thing about the ending that I wanted to ask is that we get kind of this like a little almost Indiana Jones style sequence at the end with a showdown against Belzoni, double crossing and ambushing a Nazi, but he still gets away in a sense. There's maybe a feeling that perhaps more robust justice than a handgun will get to him eventually. Why did you choose a real historical figure like Belzoni as a culprit rather than inventing one entirely? Hi there. Editor Flex here. I just wanted to let you know that in that question there, I accidentally primed Vasim Khan and myself to use Belzoni's name when the actual character we're talking about is Otto Skorzeny. Don't really know how that managed to happen and also how neither of us caught it, but hey, there you go. Keep that in mind while you listen to this answer.
The reason I chose Belzoni is one, because he's an incredibly intriguing character from the Nazi regime, one who has divided opinion. Many claim that he wasn't one of these butchers who were in charge of concentration camps or who carried out these mass pogroms, that he was a fairly honorable soldier of the old school. And, you know, he fought as a participant in the war. He fought for his country just as the Allies soldiers fought for their countries. And then he had this incredibly intriguing background where, you know, as you read the book, you discover that he'd leapt in as an assault commando to save Mussolini from ignominy. And then he'd had these adventures after the war. He'd gone on the run, he'd escaped justice, and then he'd ended up, weirdly enough, in Egypt as a main lieutenant of Nasser, the great Egyptian politician and military man. So for me, I thought that as a character from history, given that I was already using many aspects from reality, such as the copy of the Divine Comedy, the Asiatic Society, and some of the other places and artifacts that Persis comes across during the course of the novel, I felt it just fit very neatly into the overall arc of the book.
Yeah, and I guess the last thing I wanted to ask about before we wrap up is that we've been gifted the title of, at least the provisional title of the third book in the Malabar House series, The Lost Man of Dehradun, I believe is how that's pronounced. Can you give us the inside scoop on what we should expect for Persis's third outing?
Yeah, it's Dehradun or Dehradun. Either is acceptable. So in this third one, we start with a bang. We start with a man being discovered in the foothills of the Himalayas in a cave, in an icy snow cave. He's been up there for a few years. He's a white chap, it turns out. And there is something on his person, a clue that sends him to Bombay. And because he's a white man, the Indian government decides that they absolutely have to find out who he is. And so they want someone to figure out for them before, so that it doesn't become a national embarrassment that they can't figure out why this white man was murdered and dumped in this cave up in the Himalayas.
Another political hand grenade, as Seth puts it in this book.
That's absolutely right. Another political hand grenade. And as we go through the course of the novel, we discover how Dehradun fits into it and a lot of other history. I mean, my main objective with these books is obviously to showcase a good mystery. But at the same time, I'm very conscious of the fact that I want people to be immersed in both the environment of India and to get away from your local environment if you're reading this outside of India, but also to immerse you in these historical nuggets. And each of these books hopefully showcases a range of intriguing historical narratives that hopefully when you finish and you put the book down, you say to yourself, well, that was not just a good crime read, but I really learned some things.
Thanks once again to Vasim Khan for joining us here on the show this week. We'll have links up on the podcast to all of Vasim's work, and we'll have an extended version of this discussion going up on the podcast where you get to hear the actual order that it happened in, because we did splice a few things around. This is Death of the Reader. We are discussing Vasim Khan's The Dying Day. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are here discussing chapters 32 to the end of Vasim Khan's The Dying Day. Herds, first of all, I would like to congratulate you on opening 2022 with a clean sweep of points.
Really? I'm very flattered, honestly. There were definitely some points or some aspects of the story I thought you might dock a point on, but...
I have one thing I want to ask you though.
Uh-oh, I'm scared.
During our discussion with Vasim Khan, he threw you a bunch of extra points. I believe it was five.
But he threw you four.
He threw me four. Are you going to accept these five additional points on the grounds that I also received the four additional points I was offered?
Are we going to set the precedent that guests on the show can give points
this
to people?
This decision is up to you, Herz.
Yeah, no. I am 100% down for this. I love the idea of guests just coming on the show and being like, you get points for that.
Can I stipulate a rule to this, though?
Are we going to put a maximum on this?
No. There is no maximum
on
this. The rule is that we can never explicitly tell a guest that we are doing this. Mm-hmm. And if they comment to us that they know we are doing this, mm-hmm. their points are null and void.
Sounds good to me.
So if an author is hearing this discussion right now and is coming on the show later and awards us points, they cannot tell us that they heard this segment.
Do not mention the discussion. That sounds great.
All right. Fantastic.
I'm down for that. Because then it becomes a bit and we don't want that. Look, I'm into this. Points, we can take points, but only if you don't mention that you're doing it for the show. That sounds good to me. I'm into that. Yeah, sure. Look, I'll take 4 points because there was one for doing the alternate two theories. There was two for the second riddle, which I felt very, very good about, and then one for solving, I guess, enough of the story.
There were definitely some holes in the things you said.
Yeah, no way. Really? What were they?
including but not limited to John Healy being the guy who brought the Divine Comedy to India few decades before John Healy was born.
Whatever. That's fine. It would have been cool. Maybe he got taken to Nazi Germany. Look, I don't know. Maybe he got stolen. Maybe that's a story for another
time. Maybe it is.
The story of how John Holy stole back the Divine Comedy with his
maybe one
ruin.
Day John Healy was resting in the mountaintops above Italy and strode down into the valley to meet with the Leibowitzian monk.
That sounds good.
Turns out he's been alive for hundreds of years and cataloging the history of humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes his death a much bigger tragedy.
It does. If anything, it adds gravitas. I don't see why you'd be against this twist. Vasim Khan, let us write your fourth book for you. You've still got the third one in the works.
Given the people I know who are into historical fiction, and there's a few of them who listen to the show and a few of them who email me regularly for book recommendations, and I'm starting to run out. So if you notice a trend of historical fiction from me on the show, that's why.
Mm-hmm. Trying to find more fuel. I get it.
Yeah. But the thing I know that they all love about the genre is that it is basically a sounding board for them to find out about historical things that they can then maybe go read some nonfiction about.
Sure.
Which is a really cool idea. I love that as a premise of, like, you know, using fiction as a vessel to engage with nonfiction. Mm. And I think that this book does a phenomenal job of hitting that particular part of the historical fiction target demographic.
I definitely feel like I could become a Freemason at any moment now. No, I mean, look, I actually found the second riddle because I learned all the books of the Bible at a young age. I learned the Bible book rap. And I wrapped it in front of my whole grade to show how good I was at the books of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know that their names meant, you know, had literal meanings. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, you got to connect with your father on learning this particular piece of history.
Thank his Christian soul for all that he has done for me. No, I did enjoy it because,
yeah,
you know, it's always good to set off on a journey of I'm going to get entertained. And then by the end of it, think, well, I actually learned something important or at least interesting by the end of it. I think those are the best book experiences. Like, I mean, that's why when we did review season, we had, you know, what do we enjoy? What were the best murder mysteries? And like, what had the best lesson?
Yeah.
And sometimes the lesson is a history lesson, which is great. I love that.
I think the other thing I wanted to talk about with the mystery was the way that Vasim used Healy's, like, contacts.
Yes.
Well, you know, we had Belzoni in there, which was interesting because, you know, the entire thing, like,
who died horribly,
starts to come to a head when he's basically murdered at the estate that he's staying at. We mentioned last episode
so
how much we love Aaron Lockhart as a, like, representative of the Smithsonian. Mm. And how you got to Ingram aka Bruner, by realizing that like he was the odd one out who didn't really have his interrogation.
Yes.
I really liked this application of the suspect
lineup
in a non-closed circle mystery.
Yeah, yeah. No, for sure.
Yeah, it felt so organic considering how methodical it was, which I thought was really impressive.
I mean it's a reasonable extrapolation from the usual, you know, mansion house murder.
Yeah.
You go around questioning the suspects and each of them gives you a small piece of the puzzle of what happened during the night or the day or what is happening currently as people are being murdered. And then witnesses are silenced once they give up too much information or if they have a critical piece of information. So it's why Belzoni had to die, because he got too helpful.
Yes.
The man was too helpful in solving the mystery and solving the riddles. So of course he had to die.
Yeah, it was really perfect as well, because it like it didn't single out anyone in a way that made the mystery kind of feel too obvious by the end. It
wasn't too obvious, no.
The whole hook about it being Nazis and them hunting treasure in Europe and John Healy's connection to that is very obvious.
It's great.
But you're still not quite sure like what that last piece of the puzzle is.
I very much did enjoy that one of the predominant clues, Acolothio Aletheia, Aletheia, the follow the truth or follow Alice.
Yes.
We see the Greek before we see the clue that might help you put things together when we get to John Healy's apartment or his room or whatever. And we see the Hindi to English dictionary, which is the big, the almost like the smoking gun indicating,
yes,
you know, fiddle with language and try and look for double meanings in obvious words. More authors could stand to use language tricks using other languages that actually are fair play, I suppose.
That's really good.
Well, that's always the question, isn't it?
I guess the last thing that I did kind of like, which might be contentious for you, Herds, was that I like that we didn't get too deep into the metaphors of the texts in question.
Oh, goodness.
Like in a different book, you could definitely ham up, you know, like the hunting for Beatrice journey of the Divine Comedy, or, you know, going after the Mad Hatter from the Looking Glass. But I feel like you'd get something almost too operatic for The Dying Day, and I admire the restraint.
Well, this ties back into the discussion we're having at the end of part one, where I would have liked to have seen something a bit more operatic, a bit more exciting and strange.
Mean, definitely.
But that's just personal taste. I definitely think that this novel is fine the way that it is, you know?
This book hits exactly where it needs to be, and it hits a very particular type of historical fiction reader. It's not the huge, elaborate metaphor, screaming drama. It's about social issues. It's about history, and it teaches you a lot along the way.
Yeah.
And I love the way that Vasim does it. You know, it's obviously not going to be like your top pick for historical fiction, because you're a big drama boy.
It's true. I am a theater kid.
I wasn't going to say it.
It's true. Accurate.
But I think it is, you know, it just gets it right.
All I will say is that out of all the things that you've said and I've said, I will recommend this novel to anyone who wants to be educated about India, about Bombay, about Mumbai. I think that that is its strongest quality. It is the part of the story that I enjoyed the most. The other parts of the novel I enjoy, but that element there is what I would recommend for the education and the education on history there.
Fantastic. All right, Herds. What are we covering next week?
Yes, well, we're going to be doing something a little bit fun, a little bit strange.
Uh-huh.
We're only two media properties in, and we're already moving away from books, because we're going to be covering Death on the Nile, directed by Kenneth Branagh, which is coming out like this week.
Yes.
Like this is the time to go and see it. Because this time next week, we're going to be covering that and talk about our thoughts and feelings.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm excited. I hope you are too.
Yeah, that is going to be a full spoilers episode. I really enjoyed, with an asterisk, Kenneth Branagh's Murder on the Orient Express. So I am excited, with an asterisk, to see Death on the Nile.
I'm going to be honest, I haven't seen the first one. I haven't seen the Orient Express adaptation.
Oh, you and I are going to have to catch up on
that. We're
going
to have to watch that before. I have to find some time. But,
I'm looking forward to that as well. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. Thank you so much for joining us here on the show. And thank you to Vaseem Khan for this excellent book. We'll be back next week with Kenneth Branagh's Death on the Nile, freshly released film. See you then.
Yeah, see you then.